You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is a special broadcast. My name is Ben Watson, and I present a show on Wednesdays at 2 o'clock called Late Lunch Without to Lunch. So this is Late Lunch Without to Lunch, and Gamma and Simon Prentice and Bob Dobbs. And traditionally what I play before my shows is something that sounds like this.
Prince of Peace, we pray to keep strong stomachs as we slay, and gentle Jesus, give us will not to vomit when we kill. Though the whole world turn away full of anger and dismay, let us keep our lunches down and maintain an iron frown. Give us character, dear Lord, not to wince when we're abhorred, and we save us. And save us from the vice of pity as we napalm Hutton City, dear God, and dear Chicago News. Just as Eichmann killed the Jews, we must kill again tomorrow, empty us of guilt and sorrow. Simon Moon.
We're speechless.
The power of the word.
The power of the word. Saying things.
Illuminati papers.
Woof.
I'm reduced to absolute silence by that.
Well, let's play some music.
We're here to talk.
We're here to talk, Gamma.
We're here to talk and educate you, mate.
2203.
Yeah. Blues. Before that outburst from Gamma.
It wasn't an outburst. What was it? A quotation.
Before that quotation from Gamma, Bob said, "Is it all right if we squeak our chairs?" And I said to him, "Yes," because I'm interested in the fact that the written word and conceptual ways of thinking repress the physical body that's doing the talking.
Even the talking represses the physical body that's doing the squeaking.
Yes. Mm. And I suppose my love of music, particularly music from the Black American tradition, is that it seems to me to unite all the... Unite the body again, so that you're, when you watch a good percussionist, you can't tell whether it's a dance or what it is, that it's not been divided up yet, that it's unified, it's a single person moving, and you can't quite decide whether they're dancing or they're being a percussionist.
Pure Zen in action.
Well, is that pure Zen in action?
Absolutely.
Alright.
Zen is not a concept, is it?
No, it's just the way it is.
That's the interplay, the tactile rhythm, the tactile... Up and down,
synchronization.
Well, it's all together. It's, you can't decide whether it's one or the other. It is all of the above and none of the above.
And the bees in the trees are not the bees in the trees.
And the amazing thing is we've extended that as an environment we live in, technological environment, since the satellite.
What do you mean by we, Bob?
Humanity.
Humanity.
Yeah. We made this.
Humanity.
Everybody, from the top to the bottom, the middle, and of course the aliens were.
But doesn't the satellite, Bob?
What?
Doesn't the satellite actually communicate a unphysical thing? I mean, it's a screen in your living room. You're not aware of the bodies that are producing the stuff. I mean, I think Gamma's voice is quite special because you're aware of, because of its cavernous depths of a body that is echoing it, but that's why you prick up your ears. And I think most of the smooth flows that we get from media aren't telling us that there's a body. You know, they're disembodied. Isn't that right? Isn't that how you feel about media in general? That there's something dull and polished and conceptual and unexperiential about it, that you don't get flecks of spit coming out of the TV screen from the newscaster and landing on your nose.
You're talking about the content. When the satellite went around the planet, what was the previous environment? Bulldozers, oil tankers, radio, TV, music, newspapers, all the inventions. But the constitutive, the formation is happening via the satellite, because that's a new environment from 57 Sputnik on. And the interplay of the previous media is the definition of tactility. It's not any one particular thing.
But what's the difference between the satellite communication and communication by words? You could equally well...
Mediation.
Yeah, that it's something
unphysical. No, the satellite
unphysical
is an updating of the word.
Evokes images in your brain, allows human beings to flash images to and fro to each other. I can't really see that, because it's bouncing off something that you've sent up as a satellite, that there's a qualitative leap or any real change. It's language working.
Words are the content of the satellite. But if you look at any technology, it has a linguistic structure. But the nature of the original spoken body language, what you talk about, that is an exaggeration, an aspect developed. And if anything, language helps us particularize our sensibilities and point things and then spin off and then cancel them. All of our technologies were an updating of that original process that speech and body language gave us. So it's an exaggeration, a refinement, a guttering, and bringing the tetrad and flipping into a new effect. So look at these microphones and books and computers as linguistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you need to make a distinction, surely, between the technology and what that enables as an extension of the process of speaking. Where am I? I'm speaking to three of us here.
Yeah.
Whereas this allows me to speak to millions. But what Ben is talking about in terms of the process of what gets delivered, and it's content, admittedly, but the nature of the technology affects the content to the extent that to have it made available on such a scale, it has to process through so many editing filters that just produce it to blando stuff that isn't going to offend anybody because it can't afford to, you know, there's just too many numbers at stake.
If you're looking for the effect of speech, language speech affects us. The newer environments are speech-like in that they alter us. If you didn't have radio, you wouldn't have World War II. If you didn't have television. So it alters the relations of previous media linguistic structures. That's the content. The extent of how many environments are there that have been built up. So speech is not the content of radio.
Right.
No, I should say it differently. Speech is not the effect of radio. The effect of radio is the electronic implosion of everybody in the same space simultaneously.
Hearing the same thing.
Yeah, and what is that?
But in radio, everybody isn't hearing the same thing, are they? I mean,
no, it's not
turn the dial. I mean,
it's not
babble,
hearing.
It's a babble. Nostrils.
That's right. It's third nostril is really what radio extends. It's an electronic space. So that if we never had any content on radio, so the BBC broadcast silence, people would still turn it on to feel the space that everybody was sharing. That is not verbal. That's not the content. There's an experience. It's an extension. We're in this water swimming. That is the real content of radio, though it's more the form as opposed to speech.
Well, Bob, this is spookily like what Theodore Adorno argues in his recently published work, which was written in English, when he came to America and worked with Paul Lazarsfeld. And Lazarsfeld was pioneered market research.
Yeah.
And Adorno was developing the exact opposite of that. He couldn't stand this idea that you establish what public opinion is by going out with a number of options and people take it, because he was saying, what are the options? These options that people have been given are stuffing them into this a particular viewpoint.
Lazarsfeld was doing content. Adorno objected to the content projection of the rearview mirror.
He made the point, his whole new term was the hear stripe, which sounds terrible in English. It doesn't evoke anything. But what he meant was the sound of the radio when you first switched it on, the static sound. And he said a real composition for radio broadcast should be a manipulation of the hear stripe. It should affect the hear stripe. Whereas if you play an LP of Tchaikovsky, this music wasn't written to do that. This music was written to impress people in auditoria.
Yeah.
And that if you remove the huge the fact that at the beginning of Beethoven's Fifth, the da 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 makes you jump out your seat, then you can't understand the rest of the music, because he deliberately wanted to do this to people in a room. And then when you reduce it all to a record and then play it, it becomes like a transfer of a famous painting put on a tin of biscuits.
Mm.
It's not the right decoration for a biscuit tin, because if you're going to have a metal biscuit tin that's mass-produced, you could do fantastic biscuit tins, but don't go and put decals of old classical pictures on there. And so for him, the whole of... And I was quite interested to find that before... That in the 19... We're talking pre-war, building up to the war.
30s
in America. There was a lot of classical radio, and it was a kind of light, sort of kitschy, kind of middle-of-the-road classical thing.
Almost music.
And they quote... Adorno examines the letters written in by listeners, and it's all about people developing the snob appeal of the fact that they've mastered these classics.
Which was the 19th century hierarchical world that they thought they were in touch with.
Yeah, yeah. But Adorno actually came from there. He used to play Beethoven and Wagner in piano four hands with his aunt, and he understood, he went to loads of concerts, he understood what they were actually doing, and suddenly he was seeing this sort of replica being distributed via a medium, and as a modernist, he felt, why aren't they manipulating the hearstrike? Why aren't they manipulating the crackle? Why aren't they using that? I think you have to wait till rock music, really, for something that starts manipulating the crackle at its height.
Yeah. Varese is sort of going in that direction. But
yeah.
But it's interesting that, for you, it would be surprising that he was saying what McLuhan was saying.
Mm. Well, this is... I'd have to fill in listeners. I've been arguing with Bob over a few days, discussing, and I had a picture of McLuhan that Simons said was inaccurate as well to me, that... which is sort of derived from Wired magazine, from the superficial uses of McLuhan, which is generally that he fits in with cyber boosterism, with people saying new technologies are fantastic, they're transforming the world, and we're all very happy and more plugged in than before. And that's a kind of... And you've given me a completely different McLuhan, a critical McLuhan.
And he found a way to be critical in the within the Adorno problem.
And the exciting thing for me is that I find that things that I responded to thinking I was responding to artistic things that excited me, looked at in this way that you're talking about, and you could use Adorno to do it, or this critical McLuhan of yours, I understand that my reaction was actually to the power relations of particular art forms. That it wasn't simply that I didn't think Beethoven was a bad composer or a good composer or judging the art. I was estimating my own response to what is being done to you.
Yeah.
And therefore the difference between art and politics dissolves here.
Yes.
You're suddenly judging from a... You haven't got these separate categories and going, oh, but this is an artistic judgment, this is a political judgment. You're just saying, do I like what they're doing to me?
Yeah.
And 99% of the time, I don't.
Yeah? They're controlling our eyes and ears once you have electronic media.
Who are they?
You are being massaged. Us, humanity, in its own...
I'm trying to leave humanity out of the question.
Okay.
Because the humanity...
The Axis?
Hit me there.
But they are the hierarchy from the 19th century. You know, when McLuhan addressed the Bilderbergers, he said, I thought you Europeans be a little more sophisticated than the North Americans, but I find that you're as crude and live in the 19th century as my colleagues in the United States and Canada. So the hierarchy is built on our private identity. You might say property. But we don't have any private identity once the electric radio comes in. We're all sharing the same space, and we can't even articulate, verbalize this tactile space we're in.
Do you ever use, Bob, the image of the watershed? Do you know what a watershed is on a mountain?
Well, it's the just before critical mass. It's the place where things are meeting, and then they're going to flip into something new.
Yeah, I mean, if you're walking over a mountain, have you reached the watershed? When you reach the watershed, all the water on this side of the watershed is going, it's like the roof of a shed, is all going down that way.
Right.
But when you get over the watershed, all the water starts flowing the other direction.
That's
the
tipping point.
And often you're walking through a boggy morass, and it's up and down, and, where's the watershed? Where's this division?
Isn't that built by the Canadian Beaver?
Beaver. You get watersheds everywhere.
Yeah, okay, but I'm
any mountain,
beaver
you can
terms.
You can think of where the watershed is. Is it going this way or that way?
McLuhan said, and blast the beaver for its dammed up creativity. That's yes. What he said Canadians were stuck with, dammed up creativity, because they were beside the giant.
Well, this is true.
So back to your watershed point. It's like a solid
point.
Version of the gap.
Yeah, and I think in some ways you can look at what anybody's arguing and say, where are you putting the watershed? Where are you putting the great break? Where are you putting the division?
Break boundary.
And the way you were putting it then, you were saying the 19th century way of doing it, and then electronic media and radio, you're putting the watershed, and it's always seemed to me graphically obvious that when I look at Art Nouveau and Aubrey Beardsley and Victorian stuff, and then I look at Blast by Wyndham Lewis, we've got something new going on, that this is, it's early century modernism, all those movements and isms. There's an exhibition at the British Library which does them all, futurism, and I always felt, that's modernism, I love it, you know. And then what happened to me in my life was, just when I was really getting into that and that break, everyone came and said, there isn't that break, it doesn't exist, the new thing is postmodernism, and they moved the watershed. They said the watershed happened somewhere else.
Yeah.
It actually happened in 1973. You know, they it doesn't really matter. All modernism actually is romantic, sexist rubbish, and it's only later on, you know, and so moving the watershed around is just for me a word for this kind of talking about history and then picking out the where phrase, you think the big change happened.
The phrase is, which way did the second coming went? And culture today is arguing over which way it went and who did it. That's really all it is. Mm. And so even young kids by the age of saying, you were into Zappa when you were 13. Ah, man, I handled him when I was 8. Mm. I get into something
Moses,
else.
But Moses ran up the top of the mountain to get the tablets.
Mm.
And he could only go up the top of the mountain to get near the sky.
Yeah.
I think that's a...
break boundary? What's that?
Clue in for a tune.
Well, what he did... No, the break boundary of him is he took the medium of the day, the clay tablet, and started...
I didn't know he was made of clay, Bob.
I was there. I've access to the Akashic Records and the Astro Body. You want to bring in the Astro Body with me, man? I'm Astro, okay? The point is, the break boundary is the clay tablet, but he put on the precursor to the phonetic alphabet. He streamlined the huge Hebraic law down to 10 commandments. That's the beginning of reductionism.
Charles Messon.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's how we know.
Now we know.
Yeah, now we're on the same boat.
Yeah, now we're in the
same break boundary.
Same Looniverse.
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 So, Ben, you look pained. You okay?
No, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm thinking. I'm
good.
My thinking face.
He looks pained. That's a slacker.
We ain't sinking yet. The water's rising, but we ain't sinking.
Yeah, because we're not just in the physical water. We're in electronic water. River Run, the first word of Finney's Wake.
River
refers
Deep Mountain High.
Refers to the electronic.
You're
going to
leave Finnegan out of it.
You brought in Illuminati
Bob,
papers.
Can you explain to me why you go back to Wyndham Lewis and Blast, and you go back to Finnegan's Wakes, which people would call in the moments of extreme modernism, that you go back to those in order to understand what's happening now?
You saying I do?
Yeah, you
yes,
do.
Yes.
Whereas a lot of the postmodern, cyber boosting, trendy people. Their point was, you don't need to bother with all that anymore, because it's print culture. We're beyond, you know.
Right.
We don't need to worry about that stuff, that's literature, that... And, but you seem to find some way of mining a relevance in this old stuff.
Yep.
And applying it, you know...
as a counter to the postmodernist oblivion. You know, the line from Finnegan's Wake, page 52, the middle of the page, television kills, telephonium brothers broil. The eyes demand their turn, let them be seen. Now he's looking at this new radionic space, and he's saying, what's the role of the eye? We need to use all our senses. Before electronic space, we used our eye too much. Had a little acoustic balance, but we had no, this is Western industrialized countries, we didn't have any of the other senses in ratio, and even in their extensions, we didn't have them. So, if we go into this new tactile universe of the electronic, beginning with telegraph, but really happening with radio, how do you retrieve the eye so you can have a full sensorium? So Joyce wrote a book which is the content and formal principles of the radionic, but he's making you look at it. He's, remember, let the eyes be seen. What is it? Our eyes demand their turn. Let them be seen. He was retrieving the eye. And similarly, Lewis retrieved the eye, but it was called a tactile eye. as explained in Sheila Watson's PhD thesis under McLuhan. It's not the abstract eye, which Lewis was against, the photographic eye, which is the eye, like the book, in abstraction, which was the flaw from 1500 to 1900, the eye in abstraction. We now, we're toppled the eye, but if we didn't know that, we wouldn't know how to retrieve it. Joyce and the vortices, the later vortices, realized how to retrieve the eye, and therefore pointing to a harmonic sensorium. Isn't that interesting?
Okay, to understand what you're saying, I've got to think what I feel about Lewis, which is when I visit a provincial art gallery in Britain, English art's been pretty bad. You know, it's not very exciting. You go through, they might have some nice medieval-y things and some gold things, and you come through and there's sort of wishy-washy Victorian realism and this and that. And then I see a modern Lewis, and it kind of makes me wince. There's something really clenched and ugly about it.
Yeah.
That is very, very strong, and it affects you. It's like suddenly something stripped bare. It's like a skeleton, or no, it's not like, because it's inorganic.
It's not a sentimental eye.
It's got spikes in it, and it's somebody's constructed this thing in order for it to prickle you. You know, it kind of, and that just strikes me as genuinely. It's like an explosion. It's quite right that he called it Blast, you know, when he had his in Vorticism, and the magazine's called Blast, because it tells you that a picture's not a window on something else. It's some artist deciding to do something to you with your eyeball. It's affecting your eyeball. It's doing a kind of an attack on it,
activating the traditional view of the eye before the printing press as an active broadcaster. A maker of perception. Once you get into the Newtonian Gutenberg effect, the eye becomes passive and receives the light of God. But you go back to pre-literate awareness, the human is part creator of reality.
Mm. Which is why it looks, I mean, he's learning from African masks and the modernist rediscovery of, or discovery of, so-called primitive
anthropology, and
so on.
So the idea,
and that's another connection. I mean, having a two-year-old and thinking about children, that. It seems to me absolutely obvious, I mean, Zappa said it once, that he loves the natural mysticism of children, but that children's thinking and savage or primitive thinking are very similar in the sense that they
make their spaces.
Everything is coloured in what their needs, and they haven't had their sensibilities kind of flattened by a feeling of, well, that's not of science and objectivity and common sense, and it's not been refined and
flattened like a page,
flattened down. And again, that's something the postmodernists all came in and said, this is a racist idea, and you're saying children and savages are sort of lower. But that's because the postmodernists actually believe that the educated, common sense, boring person is better than children and savages. Yeah. Whereas the surrealists didn't. You know, when they made that connection, they were actually supporting this. They were saying, we can do better upbringing of children. We've got to appreciate these sides of it. You know,
you are the brain police. Maybe we should bring this into the, if we're going to talk about Zappa. I mean, something you said earlier that was just, it was Gamma's question, you know, that they are doing this. Who is they? And you said, well, it's not they. It is
humanity.
The nature of the medium.
These media.
Okay, so if we bring that to the discussion of the brain police, which is a much discussed issue.
I think that's what Frank was wrestling with, these issues, in his uneducated way, but unliterary educated.
Unliterary, uneducated, but it happens to track exactly the Frankfurt School attempt to unite Marx and Freud. I mean, he's trying to think that it's a psychic thing that the economic system does to you, and just going, psychology is irrelevant, I'm studying economics and politics. These divisions don't allow you to understand the thing. And do you ever get these sort of weird, I mean, I've seen, you know, very good lectures on psychology, and you're watching the person talk and you think, they think they're talking about psychology.
Yeah,
actually,
really.
This is all about the state and politics. They're working out in their vocabulary, and if it's a good one, in a good way, but actually they're talking about the state and classes and people. And
physics.
Not,
the conceptual physics.
Exactly.
So you were saying about the brain police. I think
Simply to say that maybe we should just explore that for a moment, in the notion that the brain police, and it's very often, you know, a them or us kind of thing, that, you know, that somehow we are victimized by this, but in fact we're complicit in it. And I think maybe we
And we have 2 points about that in relation to Zappa. What does he say early when asked, who are the brain police? He says it to you? Or no, you just know the quote.
I just know that he'd said in an early interview with in 67 with whatever his name was, Frank...
Kofsky.
Yeah, he said that the song was a religious song.
Which is always a shock.
Yeah.
Because it's well known that Frank Zappa's a critic of religion.
Yeah.
And he's a Catholic, typical Catholic, with it injected the wrong way. I mean, he's like Joyce, or he's like... famous heretic. So
now let me bring in the second point, Ben.
But calling it, he often does this, though. It's a provocative thing, because you go, you can't write a religious song. Because if he said, well, it's a song about the evil effects of religion, it would have been a really boring way of explaining it, wouldn't it?
But the illumination of it is when I asked him a question in 88, what is the Who Are the Brain Police about? He says, I'm not ready to finalize and make a statement about that.
Well, I think,
I'm still researching it.
He's still thinking about
that's
it.
That's still different.
Yeah.
That opens it up.
Yeah.
And that the religion song then becomes, it's his personal religion.
Mm.
The studying of the interplay of the organism and the event.
Yeah.
The drama of cognition.
That's a bit like your experience with quizzing Frank about lyrics, isn't it?
Mm.
I mean, it's saying it in a more explicit way to Bob, I'm still sort of thinking about it. With you, he gave you kind of puns back and wouldn't do what the hardcore, boring Zappa fans
absolutely
want.
No,
they want Frank to spell it all out for them, so you don't really need the music, because if the artist is going to tell you what it's all about, why don't they just tell you? Why do they have art at all?
In fact, we explored an example of that just this afternoon, where I was pressing him on a particular thing, because I asked him about... the frog,
Toads of the
You can't be real. You can be scared when he's too real. What is that song? I can't remember. Anyway, one shot deal. Thank you. And the first round of questions, he came back with something that was elusive and not clear. I pressed him again, and I pressed him again, and I got, well, maybe when you grow up, sort of thing. It's sort of saying, oh, that's a postgraduate question.
Mm.
In other words, you don't...
I mean, my first experience this was Den Sims of Society Pages, and he'd heard I was writing a book on Frank Zappa's lyrics, he thought it was, and he wrote to me saying, this is a very silly idea, you live in Britain, you won't know things like the pun on Oh Mine Papa is a song by Eddie Fisher, and it means a fisher, and there's this pun, and you won't get it. And he thought I was simply decoding and find like a crossword puzzle. And this actually put me off Finnegan's Wake. William York Tyndall's horrible book on Finnegan's Wake. He treats it like about, it might be deliberate to use incomprehension as part of the artistic effect.
I don't really think you should say it so much, because maybe is a better word than it, because you said Eddie Fisher, and I think you meant Eddie Calvert. Oh, mine, papa.
With a golden trumpet?
Yes.
Yeah.
So what has that to do with Fisher? Oh, well, why is it maybe to do with Fisher?
Trope mask replica.
Smart at me like that.
Neon meat dream of the octopus.
Yeah.
When the lyrics to the words that Zappa wrote for Captain Beefheart to say are all about the rubber mask, the Mexican rubber mask, if you explain it and just say, oh, it's an account of a monster movie that they used to go to, it ruins it, it flattens it, it's no longer, but whereas by producing this grotesque thing that you can't understand, it has this protest feel. It's like a gnarly, nasty thing suddenly blocking all this kind of other music on the radio, which is trying to please you and sugary, and you agree with it before you know, before you understand it, you agree with its stance.
But then,
my feeling about Finnegan's Wake, that I agree. As soon as I saw it, I agreed with it. I thought language ought to do that. The words all should jump around and funny syllables pop out. It's necessary. You know, that's good.
Ben, that's one of McLuhan's favorite statements. Yes, Finnegan's Wake. One of the statements that people like. He said Finnegan's Wake communicates before understanding.
Mm. Well, absolutely. That's
before understanding.
Yeah, before understanding the conceptual meanings.
Yeah. Well, understanding for me is like, I got it, and that phrase, it's like, I now have it. It's a very property-oriented
thing. It communicated to you something.
Yeah.
It maybe even communicated your own bias, what you hope to see in it, because it's kind of Rorschach. you do project your own thing into Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, that's true. And
but the specificity of it is actually not important. It just happens to be a certain way because that particular material at that particular time and arranged in that way delivered something that was relevant. But the actual specificity of it is not important. It's merely the pattern. It's merely the
music.
Larger picture that is the music, which is important.
Yeah, and there's very little crediting of musical values in the educated mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was my my friend Danny Houston, who said all students are a word I can't say on the radio, was his slogan, the C word. You know, that was his, he got me shouting it on the street. You know, I had to get this idea, all students, because he'd tried to be a student and failed. And he was very bitter.
Nothing to do with that, of course.
But what the education seems to be doing is depriving people of understanding things in this direct way, which seems to absolutely screw up their responses to music. So New Musical Express, as a forum for debate about music, was very confused, and you had a lot of literary graduates trying to judge music, and it's all based upon morals and
politics
and the words, and no one's actually working out whether the bass is trembling their thighs or making their, you know, things squeeze, and the actual aspects of music.
They had to take drugs to feel that.
They had to take drugs.
That's absolutely.
Yeah. Let's have some music.
You want some music?
Well, just have a little break so we can go and take some drugs and have some music.
We don't do that here at Resonance.
Well, I've got to take my simvastatin.
Yeah.
Before I go to sleep.
Mm.
That's right, you heard right. The secret word for tonight is mud shark. And of course, with the mud shark, secret word is the mud shark arpeggio. A marvelous little arpeggio. And now, the mating call of the adult male mud shark. The mud shark dancing lesson. Let me tell you the story about the mud shark. Bring the band on down behind me, boys. The origins of the mud shark are as follows. There's a motel in Seattle, Washington, called the Edgewater Inn. The Edgewater Inn is built out on a pier, so that means that when you look out your window, you don't see any dirt. You got a bay or something out in your backyard. And to make it even more interesting, in the lobby of the aforementioned motel, there's a bait and tackle shop where the residents can go down whenever they want to rent a fishing pole and some preserved minnows and schlep back up to their rooms. Open the window, stick their little pole outside, and within a few minutes, actually catch a fish of some sort that they can bring into their motel room and do whatever they want with it. You know what I mean? Now in this bay, there's quite a variety of fish. Not only do they have mud sharks up there, they got little octopuses that you can catch. And all of these denizens of the deep can come in real handy. Let's say you were a traveling rock and roll band called the Vanilla Fudge. Let's say one night you checked into the Edgewater Inn with an 8mm movie camera. Enough money to rent a pole. And just to make it more interesting, a succulent young lady with a taste for the bizarre. My mind drifts back to a meeting, a chance meeting in the Chicago O'Hare Airport, where the members of the Vanilla Fudge told Don Preston about a home movie they made at the Edgewater Inn with a mud shark. And I'm going to tell you, this dance, the mud shark, is sweeping the ocean.
And how? Every segment begins with gamma.
Very good. Mm.
Nothing begins.
So mud sharks, are they emergent life from the mud? Are we going back into the prehistory of the natural history of Homo sapiens? Mud shark.
Well, that's, we are, with new media, we don't actually have this chemical body. We have new organs, new species, new things added to us, and surrealism, Max Ernst paintings describe the new bodies that are added to the chemical body, or what we call the physical body. So, yeah, we are...
Enhancing the wetware.
Yeah. So the wetware is more the hardware and software. So, McClune used to say that surrealism was just a documentation of what was going on. Nothing odd about it. It made total sense. He almost thought it was too literal.
Yeah, Bob, I had an interesting experience today, which was, where was I? I was on Gray's Inn Road. And because of, for the last 9 days, I've got a new baby. And when you've got two children, you get very confused about what you're doing. And so... I, like, S has taken over this bag, which I, for the last 6 months, I haven't lost anything because I have a bag over my shoulder and I know everything goes in there, everything's completely sorted, everything's that bad. But then she took it over because Mordecai, the new baby, needs nappies, and that was the nappy bag, so she had that, so I didn't have the bag. And I needed to document this show on mini-discs, and I've run out of mini-discs, and I need to get mini-discs, so I leave... We're in the Parents Resource Centre behind Coram's Fields, which is a special place for children. It's kind of, do you know Coram's?
Yeah.
It's sort of child utopia.
Yeah, yeah.
For,
absolutely.
And so I tried Zavi in the ex-Virgin place in the horrible New Brunswick Centre, and they don't have any mini-discs. So I've got to go to Pro Tape on Percy Street off Tottenham Court Road, which is a long way, but you sort of cut through, you know, and try to come back cutting through. So I bought £20 worth of mini-discs so I could document. And I took them back, hung them on the peg. Then because I didn't have my bag, I didn't put it in my bag, so I left them behind. Ooh. And then we get on the 46 bus, and we go right at the end of the other 46 bus route to a treetop, so Iris can play, and I have to get on the bus and go back. So I go back on my own. And when you're with people, the results of the conversation the day before don't percolate because you're attending to the new people. You see, I'm even making gestures like Paul. Do you notice this thing? I'm noticing how Bob's been talking to me so much that I'm starting to develop his, try and emulate his punchy way of talking, and I'm doing similar gestures.
When you learn, you're miming. Mimesis is learning.
Yeah.
You're miming.
Exactly. Absolutely.
SpongeBob.
SpongeBob. Yeah.
Go ahead, Bob. So you're going back. New people.
I'm going back. And so I'm thinking about what we said to each other, and I'm sitting at a bus stop on my own, waiting for the bus to take me back to my family. I've now found the mini disc that were there, and I'm watching people walking down the street, the Gray's Inn Road, and they start looking really strange. I get a shock, and it gives me that little whiff of when I went really crazy in 83, 84. When everybody looked as if they were dressing up.
Halloween.
They put on these clothes to look like something as they walk down the street. They're not really a milkman. They're kind of dressed in that costume in order to go out and be a milkman, but it's sort of ludicrous. And all these people are walking down this narrow strip called the pavement, and they're all walking in lines, overtaking each other down this long grey road, Gray's Inn Road. And why are they doing it? They're kind of performing this complete absurdity, and suddenly I felt I was an alien observing this.
Yes.
I was off my planet, on this horrible, weird planet, and there are all these people,
alive.
And they're aliens.
They live.
And this is quite without
pumpkin.
Any drug.
I could explain this.
You know,
Ben.
Influence. It's your... I see your function, because people get very annoyed with you because you tell tales that you can't credit. You know, you force things around.
Well,
and you know. But it
later.
Seems to me that you're doing a kind of... Surrealism's all in the museums. Everybody knows what it is. So pictures, they're great pictures by great artists, and that always kills everything. It doesn't work at all, because you go and try and emote in front of them, and then you can't, and you think, I'm a Philistine, I don't like art, and you know, blah, blah, blah. But what you're doing is an act of surrealism to try and make us look at human beings more objectively than we normally do, because normally you sit at a bus stop and you're just thinking about catching
the
bus.
You're in the warmth.
Yeah,
the absurdity passes you by.
And suddenly, it just, the absurdity of how people were dressed in their different clothes and the little signs they're giving off of their differences, and the guy with the peaked hat who thinks he's this is going along. And it was chilling. You know,
explained it, Ben. You are a primitivist, we talk about the body. The body, to me, is first nature, and we don't know its constituents. We're still exploring it. And our media, our second nature that humans made, is a means of exploring it. I think what happened to you is you actually stopped looking at first nature as the ground, the body, and you looked at second nature. You had gone out of the dream of the body, and now could see the second nature, and it stood out starkly absurd to you, because you no longer were inside the dream of the body. Mm-hmm. Now we're inside the dream of media. In clothing. Mm. And that's what I'm emitting.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
But once you're alerted to it, I mean, I thought my...
You
I
mean,
mean I,
like
I've
nocturnal
probably
emissions?
Think
yes.
That the only natural way to relate to the buildings and the bodies would be actual civil disobedience. If we were having a riot and we were all running and we were over here and people were over there and everything became exciting and playful and we could, you know, build a pyramid of cars in the middle of the road,
putting
then
on
everything,
the second
that would be real.
Yeah, putting
but
on
this,
the second
this nature. Straitjacket thing that everybody's doing is just completely ridiculous.
Because they're following rules we're unconscious of. Not just rules of bureaucracy.
And they're scowling.
Rules of the medium.
They're walking along looking so unhappy. You know, it's just like, they're not talking to each other. They're not mentioning, they're not aware of the other human because they're locked and they're on their mobile phone to someone at the other side of London. They're locked.
Who's actually inside
them?
And they're actually going nowhere. That's if they're on the cell phones more and more, pretty soon we'll have a chip, someone will be communicating, and it'll be absurd that we're actually going in around with things that seem to be going someplace because there's nowhere to go in digital space. That's why the economy collapsed.
But when I went mad, I was like a drunk who always talks to everybody immediately. You know, when you there's a drunk in a pub, and you go for a pee, and he's there, he just says what's on his brain straight to you, like he knows you, and it's like
he thinks you're a human being.
He's
trying to establish contact.
But in fact, that's why waste. Why are we wasting time having friends? Why aren't we just straight away report what we think
to anybody who happens to be there?
Well, because there's no reason not to. I mean, it's...
Exactly.
And all this kind of special list of special friends that you have to have,
it's
such
a
difficult
waste,
to keep that network going. And, you know,
and look at the fun we had in the store. We got the wine. We started interacting with the cashier and getting a little pleasure.
Yeah.
Right? Just because we said, oh, he's a human being, we made fun of her situation. Made fun of our situation.
I mean, I've noticed it sometimes with Esther when we're feeling very... excited about some political idea, and then we're talking, and suddenly you realise everybody's getting really uncomfortable because they're feeling this is a conversation they could join in on. You know, you're voicing some current satisfaction, like prices going up.
But they can't. they're frustrated because they can't.
Well, yeah, because it's sort of dangerous. It feels like they're going to...
Well, that's what freaked everybody out about cell phones. You know, 10 years ago, people were going around in the buses and streets talking away.
Yeah.
Now, notice how we've gotten used to that.
But it's never anything you could join in on. It's usually a very boring person.
Well, that's why it was alienating.
Yeah.
But we've gotten used to it.
Yeah. Well, people are a bit politer. They're sort of aware of it. It's usually now somebody who's a bit stupid who's just got a mobile phone and broadcasts their private life all over the bus, and everybody's wincing.
Well, we don't get that in New York. I mean, everybody's yelling and screaming on their cell phones.
Yeah.
But that may be unique to New York.
The North American volume is distinctly higher.
Going out to be alone. McLuhan's point. North Americans go out to be alone. They think they're alone. All other cultures go out to be social.
Yeah,
it's an interesting pattern.
Well, that's the extreme individualism, isn't it?
And sorry, Bob, can I ask you a question?
No. Okay, go ahead, Cameron. All right. I'm just voicing both sides of the issue by saying
which
no and then yes. The issue of you asking me a question.
50-50.
You asking me a question.
Our dream individualism of the later Zappa.
It's about the Republic of Texas.
Yes. How did you know about that?
You told me.
Oh, right. You want to bring that up?
No,
what was your question?
I don't subscribe to the concept of
which the 911 victim,
you know, a kind of a groovy hand
911 victim
member.
What's happening here?
Scene at the beginning. I really don't think it was
messing around with the mic.
Yeah. I'm in control here.
In control.
So what were you?
He's a scrutinizer.
Spoken with Jimmy Carl Black recently and talked to him about that, you know, original Mothers thing. It's clear that there was very little in the way of really. Yeah. I mean, it was
camaraderie. It wasn't the real.
Really.
And you're saying you're finding that out now.
Well, Ben just thought you missed that. Ben was just saying that the kind of extreme individualism of Zappa and his, you know, his almost focusing it down to, you know, FZ and it's a brand and this is it and I am it and, you know, everything else is just work for hire. Didn't that make me feel queasy in some way? And I was just saying, well, yes, but. In retrospect, I'm not so sure that you know the myth,
just
the,
great,
the mothers, and this wonderful kind of
It's not that I prefer the convivial mothers so much as it's a disturbance I have in my own about individualism because I really agree with following your own proclivities and indulging those obsessional things that turn you on and you should.
Yeah.
And this is the whole way. There's hardly ever normal sex in Frank Zappa. It's always something that would be very embarrassing to admit to anybody you did or and that is a kind of, it's a symbol for a whole set of ideas about what how you can unleash your real powers and that the musicians I like insist on remembering the sort of weird compositions they did when they were 12 and they remember the smell of the paper and they remember all that. It, by insisting on that, it seems to me you produce the kind of vividness that I like in artworks. But I find that a bit different from the, you know, his initials and the kind of, it's almost like a polished representation of that rather than, he's not really going at what he really wants to smell and revealing himself. It's a kind of artifactual sort of idea.
He's going into his matrix. He's going into his matrix, dude.
Yeah,
and he gets into the digital. He's one of the first people.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, he's dealing with it. He's taking it to another level. And we were talking earlier today about using dust, you know, the interstitial dust.
Digital dust.
In the sense of it.
Yes.
But for me, that would be finding the knobbly, gnarly, incomprehensible thing within the midst of all this smoothness. So aesthetically, I agree with that. I can. Yeah. There's no problem. That's the satisfaction of finding a particularly crinkled bogey up your nose. You know, it's like it's finding that one.
Yeah.
And I think nose picking is all over Frank Zappa's
earlier.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Know, that. That finding that in the self, I'm thoroughly in favour of. That's really good. But the, you know, when you had the logo for the band became Zappa done in that bulbous lettering, just his name.
Mm.
Not that he ought to be in a group, but, I mean, it's such a cliche of rock, though. Do you start off in a band and then you drop everybody and you end up as the solo? I mean, you know, it's David Essex in Stardust, you know, it's the same pattern.
Miles Davis.
Right.
It's interesting that, you know, the Miles Davis phenomenon in the 50s, McLuhan said that was the tribal African, the semi-literate African, though all North American African-Americans are not Africans. Mm-hmm. They don't have the same cultural environment.
Well,
so we're actually all the same kind of people. So when the tribal success of swing and jazz in the 30s, by the 50s, the North American black now is going to put on the bourgeois individualist, the isolation. That's new to them. Mm. What are the white guys doing? Ginsberg, they're going group, tribal, and beatnik. So you see cultures flipping. Yeah. Yeah. And so Frank, as a tribal Italian, using music as a medium, but being an immigrant guy who's just getting into individualism, he actually was learning how to go out to be alone. And you could sociologically analyze the concepts of xenochrony, of avoiding synchronicity. If we think of synchronicity as a kind of merging, he was trying to avoid it, to maintain this new feeling of individual, independent, artistic genius. So he actually was a total product of the sociological meme of America, which he would never have known. Mm-hmm. In that sense, he was a 19th century person. He didn't know what was driving him to reinforce his individuality. So yeah, for a lot of people, rock and roll is tribal. Mm-hmm. And that is why Frank gets isolated. He went against the medium of the people's choice, which was from young kids. That now, we get digital, now the kids are totally different today. They want their little MySpace. They're all Frank Zappa now. MySpace. FZ everywhere. That's interesting. It's like how Lewis predicted the future condition in his own punk attitude. So we could look at these guys as cultural phenomenon. Mm. So, but you like the artifact.
I'm opposed to celebrity culture, and I don't like daydreams about a person.
He was projecting? Do you think that was...
Well, I don't know, but it's definitely a sickness within Zappology of people who...
Cecil Daydream Lewis.
They imagine themselves being Frank, and they... Everything around it is not being themselves looking at an artifact. It's an imagination about being someone else, and I find that a bit sad, you know? I mean, developed into liking being yourself, but always wishing that you were this other person in your imagination.
Yeah, and Frank said that we create an art that's in an environment that's hostile to dreamers.
Yeah.
This whole dream element, I think you raised this in your book.
Well, I raised it with him. I said, do all people have interesting dreams? And he said, well, I've heard some pretty miserable stuff from people telling me their dreams, which I thought was a very funny reply. But I was trying to find out if he shared the kind of surrealist democracy idea that everyone's unconscious is a kind of... Mm. is amazing. If people could access their unconscious, we'd all be fantastic. You know, that...
Yeah. Yes, but we have the subconscious externalized. That's what the electronic environment is, the extension of the central nervous system, the dream, interior landscape, and joy.
Absolutely.
Is the dream.
And this
but
is why
the
I oppose
theological dream.
I hate New Age and sort of
dreamy dreams.
Psychotherapy ideas of what the unconscious is, because I explore the unconscious in the material. The funny little thing that happens to be printed on the back of the record that you look at and you study, that is your unconscious, because you haven't noticed it before. It was unconscious, it's having an effect on you. And talking about that and analysing it is actually what Freud does in analysing dreams. He takes all this clutter, all these funny little bits and pieces that people come out with, and then gets the people to remember all about them and make the connections and take seriously this contingent, random rubbish.
Right.
And taking seriously that is taking seriously ourselves, because we are just always random, contingent rubbish is what we're living through.
We tend, under the print medium, to think that we were continuous. The electric ages retrieve the sense of fragmented discontinuity. But our unconscious right now at this moment is the internet. Mm. Right here. It's our unconscious. Are we thinking of how we're echoing within that effect? And people who are in the internet effect and imagine it's something, how are they responding to what we're saying, and what is the part that's not understood?
But I was very upset with the internet, because whenever I Google my name, which is obviously the first thing you do when you Google, I always found these people being so unpleasant about me, these hardcore Zappa fans, you know, because they were into the web long before we were. And so it always left this really bad taste in my mouth, the internet sphere, because the discussions were so stupid. Yeah. And these people were so insulting they're insulting without standing there and then saying, I've insulted you, what are you going to do? You know, they disappear. They're not there.
Well, that's the internet. It's quantum. It's the little particles. Yeah. You're looking for a continuity of yourself, and their response to it, they're just there to stick something in your eye. That's what the internet makes people want to do.
Yeah, but
why does it make them want to do that?
But all the people that I encountered who are obsessed with the net through music and everything were always doing incredibly weak, self-deluding music.
Yeah.
They weren't ever doing music which had any objectivity and strength, and it wasn't...
But see, it's like being on acid. Remember, people thought they were making good music on acid?
Mm.
Then they heard the recording and they were shocked. Mm. Well, we're on LSD or heroin with the internet.
Right,
and so we think we're communicating something that's matching with our desires.
Mm.
That's the content.
Mm. Yeah.
The fact that our unconscious has been extended and imploded and fragmented. The internet fragments people into individual spaces. MySpace. Nobody was going around, and Abbie Hoffman wasn't going MySpace. He was saying WeSpace.
Well, for me, the most extraordinary experiences I've had have been in upstairs rooms in pubs when people doing extremely abstract music manage to make everybody pay attention to what they're doing, even though what they're doing is like no music they've ever heard before.
Mm.
But it's very easy to... I mean, the classic thing is you play Heard It Through the Grapevine by Marvin Gaye, everybody knows it, and it's a wedding, and they all come out and lift their feet up and down to it, like, and it's kind of crushing, terrible experience, even
like
though I love
Japanese
Marvin Gaye,
movie.
That song, I just can't, you know, if you play that, everyone dances, and that's meant to be having a good time.
Like an old Japanese movie.
Of getting everybody paying attention in a room to somebody who themselves doesn't know what they're going to play next, but we all really mind about it, and your kind of ears ache with the tension. That seemed to me the model of what communication could be. And then people say, well, I must be a technophobe, because I'm saying it could be done. But that's not quite true, because, well, am I a technophobe? But I don't want them to play, they can't do it by playing folk music or playing romantic music. They've got to play this thing which has silence and waiting in it, and you don't know how long the gap is going to be before it comes in,
You're in love with the interval. So you're in love with the tactile.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking here.
Yeah.
Was that and how that? Yeah, because... No, I'm not saying it's bad. But that's the precise description of the weather of Ben White.
Do you find this tactile word very confusing?
I do. I'm still...
Because it comes up all the time.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's the word for everything.
Mudshark. And then... The secret word tonight. Yeah. Tactile.
The secret word. Yeah.
And Bob, do you find this? Bob makes me reflect on jargons and on terminologies and...
Right.
The way that people sort things out in their own set of vocabularies, and what's interesting for me is where you push that vocabulary against another vocabulary, and then people say, you're eclectic.
Yeah.
As if all thinking wasn't a collage and an eclecticism. But
I think Simon should say something.
Yeah, well, there's a red light on. Sorry.
I mean, what you were saying about the experience in the pub, I mean, that might be described by some as eclectic, but I mean, what you're talking about is a moment of...
Do you mean the experience on Gray's Inn Road? No, in the pub?
No, I'm talking about in the pub. The one you described...
Ah, we had a drink in the Blue-Eyed Maid before we came in.
I'm talking about the conceptual experience, the upstairs room in the back of the pub.
Ah, right, upstairs, where free improvisation happens.
Real communication that was going on between real people that was not freeze-dried, and they were actually doing something that was communicating with everybody in the room because they were there and they were all listening intently and it made sense to them in the moment and it was not being controlled or in any way programmed by anything other than the nature of the circumstances there. And that does relate to Gray's Inn Road, because everybody on the Gray's Inn Road is doing the exact opposite thing. They're just running on tram lines going in one particular direction, and that also relates to, in a broader sense, the culture, and might perhaps come back to what we were saying about education and people being unable to dig music, because dig music,
perfectly good word
with a spade, because they're on the extension of that tram line, which is the educational process, which is the culture, which is the problem with culture, which by extension...
Linear culture, kind of culture.
Well, yes, I mean, and the
and irony... And culture is a personal possession and a personal achievement.
Property,
isn't it? I've got here, and I can appreciate this and this and this, and therefore I'm...
Yes, but also needing to acquire all the little... So tick all the little boxes about all the things that you should know about so that you can show those things off against all the other people who know those things and make all those points. And it's
which is why we're so grateful for the zappological sabotage of that, because he suddenly takes the thing that's absolutely the worst thing that you could think of and puts it straight there.
Mm.
And makes you like it usually by the end. I mean, you're prepared to...
Well, he disorganizes it.
Yeah.
You know, and
well, he disorganizes what Bourdieu would call distinction.
Mm.
But the people who think that's all culture is, he's a complete nihilist. But if you think, I mean, do you think the me and Dallas Bohner, we are revolutionary classicists. We think there are golden sections and there are proportions,
right.
And that there is an abstract. I mean, we're Mondrian people,
showers.
And we think in good music there is this ability to measure and construct properly. So, which is why Johnny Guitar Watson is like Varese. That that underneath is an understanding of distances and measurements and weights.
I don't know whether it's an actual overt conscious understanding, but if you're saying there is that within it, yes, I agree with you.
Or you're saying that
Johnny Guitar Watson has figured out these measurements and weights and balances and...
He's figured out how to do it.
Yes, he's figured out how to do it.
And what he wants is this... that good music, and this is like a Lewisian idea, mm-hmm. is hard. Good music is clear... and it knows where it is. You can draw a picture of it.
Right.
Whereas bad music is a mush. It's a kind of soma. It kind of flows over you.
It's a maybe. It's a maybe bad. Maybe good.
Yeah, yeah.
If you like it, get on with it.
Let me just interject.
I'd like to apologise to Johnny Guitar, who's listening in Kentish Town, maybe, because I brought this tape down of the thingamajig.
I'd like listeners to write in to Resonance and say it's a disgrace that there is no cassette player on this deck.
On Resonance.
I mean,
there's no way to play a cassette that's handwritten.
And people who are used to mini disc recordings and all the compression going on get real surprises with cassette quality because it's so immediate
and
raw sounding. You get really good. I'm so pleased to discover this because I always thought all my recordings of upstairs rooms of these events were useless because they were hissy tape recordings. They weren't digital. But I'm finding that actually sometimes if I can play them on here,
I know. Let me say something. In light of artifacts being linguistic.
Yeah.
What you experienced in the room and everybody was hypnotized by, what are people originally and always...
I don't like the word hypnotism.
Okay, involved, fascinated. Like fascinated by, sorry, well, I said
hypnosis.
From another culture, it looks like hypnosis.
Yeah.
But they are fascinated by someone when he stutters. That'll draw you in.
Yeah,
so that music that you, that environment, they were watching a stuttering action in relation to music. You like that? You like that one?
I do like that. Yeah, reminds me of my good old friend Eamon. Yeah,
I mean the stuttering.
He stuttered very well, and he was Irish.
I mean, one of the techniques of pre-improvisation is you aim for the note that you can't quite play, and it produces a trembling, a tense.
Yeah,
it's a soft pitch.
That gets dealt with itself. All these things are being dealt with, you know, because they don't like being bored, so they're thinking about it. So then they find that just becomes a texture, and when they're overlaying textures, and then they have to do something to absolutely blow that up. So it's continually being, there's no sort of kind of there are free improvisers who settle into positions and produce a dependable product, and people really into free improvisation dismiss those, and we don't like them. But this is should be being thought about all the time while it's being played.
And I say that effort to get to that ineffable note is an attempt to explain or express tactility. The concrete example of it.
Yeah, concrete.
Because tactile is not a sense, it's the interplay. So all of the arts and sciences in the 20th century in the tactile electric environment went into hypervolume and extreme Baroque spirals because they were all trying to touch the Zen consciousness.
But my complaint is about how people within free improvisation generally...
Gamma started to get off, finally took it off.
...can't see the point of Frank Zappa.
And
the Frank Zappa people can't see the point of free improvisation, and it seems to be these different camps. And yet, both are saying that what you thought you liked in music, the substantial groovy rhythm or the substantial big brass noise, is not the point. That it's nihilistic about all these values embedded in it. That the point is something else. That isn't all these things that you continue to
perceive.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not non-sensory. The tactile.
I feel
we've got long enough. I'm glad you're taping this. After 3 hours, we're going to have an understanding of tactile. I've never been given the opportunity within conversation in a stretched out situation that we can.
Can we start from the etymology? I mean, it's touch.
I was just going to say, can we have a? Yeah.
I find it odd because Esther had a funny conversation with you about it because it's a big thing in Benjamin.
Yes,
but it's quite simple in Benjamin. It's not quite such a big concept in Benjamin because it means actually touching things. So, with the mass commodity. you know, books and things mass-produced, you get to touch them yourself, whereas artworks are preserved and you can only stare at them, right. And therefore you have a completely different relationship to them.
Right, and so Lewis makes the painting stick in your eye.
Yeah.
You know, get through the passive eye, you tickle it, but hurt it too.
Mm.
So the tactile is not just the pressure kinetic contact. It's the letting go of something you're touching, and then you touch it again. Think of that interval and rhythm.
So, I mean, it's almost like a word for your involvement or your...
Yes.
The fact that...
Your fascination of living.
It changes if you get up and leave.
Yeah.
Everyone feels really shocked and upset that you are saying, I think it's bullshit, this stuff. I don't like it. So one person less is into it. And it's and when you don't like free improvisation, deciding to get up and leave is a big thing. And so your presence is affecting how the music is working.
Exactly.
Like, the air around you changes. And there's more
Remember
space
how Frank said he liked to mold the air? In the big arenas. That's a tactile bias. He wants to sculpt the nothing.
Ice hockey rinks.
But that's a much
more... Ice hockey rinks. Sorry,
yeah, ice hockey rinks.
That's a much more conventional...
Billy the hockey... He talks about Billy the Puck or Billy... I heard an interview in 1971 when he... In New York promoting 200 Motels. And he and the DJ gave him a Rorschach ink block thing, you know. And he says, what do you see? And he says, I see Billy with the hockey stick. Me, being a Canadian, thought he was talking to me directly.
Yeah.
Years over.
And
that.
This is the interesting
stuff. And then he puts Puck in that, what album, Roxy, or one of those? The Puck.
Yeah.
Remember Puck in the.
Yeah. That Frank Zappa creates paranoid listener because everything's talking straight to you.
Yes.
And you find these things that relate to your own. Now, objectively...
So his big album is a big Rorschach thing. Like Fingers Wake, you dive into it.
What is this uncanny... How does this uncanny effect get achieved? How do you do it to people? How is it
if
that
you understand
so many different people
if you
get
can
the same feeling it's talking directly to me?
Because if you approximate...
Is it because of the quantity of little signs
debris.
In it?
Debris.
You know, there's stacked up pinheads thing. There's enough for everybody. Pinheads. Everybody can get something because there's so much in there.
No,
the there's so much actual material that's been digested and is there. And, there's so much...
You can only do it to a literate audience. The literate audience becomes a monad, or the literate individual through the printing medium. Then you take the massage, the acoustic, multi-level, multi-sensuous massage through modern electric media like Frank had. It will bring out... the basic feature of the individual, his monadic print sensibility, and he'll feel paranoid. He can't hold on to his little billiard ball of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So what would a Japanese person, would they have those? Does he make Japanese consumers paranoid? Does he make Chinese?
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because Simon, can you?
He doesn't send these and shit.
Less than he does in other cultures, but that's partly due to the problem of language and just lack of exposure. But he certainly does make them feel that way. I mean,
he makes them feel paranoid.
He has the same effect on them that he has.
But
on
they're illiterate. They were becoming very literate. Now we'd have to say, well, what about a 1920s Japanese?
Mm-hmm.
These are industrialized, literized people, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. actually they become literate as we go tribal because the tactile electric environment threatens mm-hmm. every cultural bias. Mm-hmm. So the Japanese, they invaded the universities over here in the 70s.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Hyper-literate desire.
Totally.
But they can't be. They don't know how to do it, just like we can't be Asian or non-literate. That's the confusion.
I'm going to fight you on this one.
Well, no, that's good, which is just the other part I didn't say, because I'm tactile.
I mean, it's I'll fight you simply on the grounds.
Let's keep it limited.
It's a spectrum thing, and I don't think it's that they can't. It's just, it's getting back to answer your question first, because it's probably maybe the key thing. How does he achieve it? How does he do this thing? I think it's just, I mean, it may be what you said as well, in a terms of a more abstract sense, but it's just the nature of the nose-picking, if you like. I mean, he's writing songs about nose-picking. essentially.
What about the Uncle Meat?
Songs about those.
Well, the booklet of Uncle Meat.
Also the
booklet about Uncle Meat. Yeah. Uncle Meat altering the sound effects. Remember the story of the Uncle Meat booklet? That's about a scientist working with sound. He talks about interviews. We'll make you have a bowel movement. So he was almost aware of that he was making these strange effects on people and claiming he was a scientist about it. Just want to throw that in there.
Okay, yeah, but,
his father was a scientist.
That's right. Yeah.
That's why I had to move back.
He worked for the government.
The government, but like what do you do?
Now, here's the thing. Well, that's what I do. In the Toronto Star in 1969...
Which government?
Solar government.
Solar government.
Solar panels.
An unusual personal experience. You know, everybody has unusual personal experiences. And most of the time, you don't like to talk about them because people don't talk about
them. Well, that's sin. In the Christian Platonic system, that's sin because... Yeah. What is good is abstract and like God, and but these little specific things
even without going there,
are sin.
There is a cultural
and Zappa's work is constructed of nothing but sin. It's all sin.
And Christopher Rick says it's all backwards, talking about Dylan's sin. Conception or obsession with sin. You know, that's just thesis of his book.
The point about Japanese people and whether we might have an argument about that. But my conception of it would be that, you know, Zappa is about derailing those cultural tramlines at all kinds of levels. You know,
and he comes at a time where he has a tactile medium to threaten all culture. Okay. Yeah, Rumpelstiltskin.
But that derailing everything doesn't mean that we're left with nothing. It's
no,
not.
Absolutely not.
I mean,
but you're thrown back to your own resources. You're thrown back to your own ability to, instead of recognizing something, going, oh, that's 4/4 with a middle eight or whatever. It's not that. It's something else entirely. So you have to create a personal relationship with it to like you would in the room with the improvisation.
Well, this is actually how modern classical music develops in its purest sense. There is no schema that allows you to write. You have to face a new schema and make up your mind about what you think about it. But there isn't a Baroque system which you can compose within. Everything, you have to create
but
your own system each time.
Was
here comes everybody.
Do you mean like the wall may be blue?
Well, I think there is a system, and then it's being stretched all the time.
Yeah.
You know, the Beethoven, you know, that there is the sequence of Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven.
The extreme end of that, but I think it's all, I mean, the cutting edge is always open.
The stars may be going out.
It's always rejecting what came
from. There's some music. Take a break.
But I had a... I had a question I wanted to ask you, Simon.
Ben, can I just respond to just a little continuity here? The idea that it makes you decide, or co-create... That's the general understanding of modern art, is it makes the viewer get over the passive eye that the printed book had created, and now you become a multi-sensuous creator, and that's really tactile, in the sense you acknowledge the making part of your consciousness. That you can apply that to all the arts. All the arts have moved towards that from 1900 to 2000.
Richard.
That was the avant-garde. That's what they're really trying to show.
Yeah, we keep having from you these sort of sketches of the total development.
Broad cartoon outline.
Which leads towards a kind of sociology and a descriptive sociology, whereas my way of putting it is always going back to an aesthetic distinction, which means that therefore I'm putting my own point of view forward, that I like this and I don't like that, and I want us all to agree on an aesthetic. So I'm talking about aesthetics.
That's what you do. Why are you... Do you know why you want that? Or why you do that?
Because I really like some things and I really don't like others, and I want to explain to everybody why, so I don't feel so lonely.
DNA.
You think that if you get your preference, wish, desire, or satisfaction across someone else, that's getting rid of your loneliness?
Yeah,
then,
if I can explain
everybody
it.
Would be skipping down Gray's Inn Road as if they were doing a dance contest, and then they'd all be on another tram line, you know, so...
Well,
that's right.
It takes one to know one.
Well, I think my idea of what everybody should have been doing would have changed the fabric of our society towards something else. I would have wanted a real situation in which we don't know what happens next.
Yeah.
Well,
that's what we actually do have. It's just that people refuse to accept that.
I have a question of obscure zapological fact, which might entertain people and ground us a bit. And it's to ask Simon, because me and Bob have been through this. Do you remember the sequence in 200 Motels where Ringo Starr, dressed up to look like Frank Zappa, is composing in his room, in his motel room, and he rubs the coffee into it because he wants it really dirty. Well, what else does he do? Because I was thinking about Zappa's openness to contingency. Like, he did a reply to somebody who said, asked him a horrible question, where do you get all your great ideas from? And he says, I read them off the autocue like you. And so little Iris at age 2 and 3 quarters does that. You ask her, what is the big monster? She look up and sees the clock and says, the clock. Mm-hmm. She just takes the cues from everything immediately around her, and they just come out. And Frank was doing that. He saw an autocue and just threw that in.
Yeah, but he was also destabilizing.
Exactly. Works. It worked. Yes. So what else goes into the composition? Can you remember? Was there any of Bob's electronic media involved? Or was it just coffee and
I think
pen?
He had a tape recorder in the bag, and I think he has that out and he's listening
right.
to it. And then
so you heard that as
the
tape recorder?
Yeah,
because he goes, I know, just what, those boys,
that,
just what I need,
he scribbles it and puts some more coffee.
Because me and Bob always thought that he was turning on the radio at random.
No.
I always thought he turned
but
the radio.
But in analysing, I realised, it's Larry the Dwarf's recording to the band, and it's his, it's a self-portrait of
That's
Frank
right.
getting excited with his bootleg recordings of the band, because when he played me Phase 3, we talked through the music, but as soon as the voices came on, you've got to listen to this.
Yes.
It was like he loved these things improvised by other people more than his own compositions, because they were excited. They were the bit which was sort of still flashing stuff for him. They hadn't been digested yet. Whereas the music, he wasn't intent that I...
Okay, so there's a point. Frank Zappa was not become an individualist genius, emphasizing his own creativity. He used the materials around him and self-effaced himself.
Yeah,
so he was
totally.
Postmodern in that sense.
Yeah.
So where was FC? That's the question. Where was FC going? What was he at? Other than that the satellite... He was predicting digital space.
Well,
I'll say that Frank was anticipating the Matrix. And it wasn't him going into that, because he could see through it. FZ was...
Mm.
FZ was going into the digital dust. Who's FZ? Larry Dwarf. What's the other one?
Rumpelstiltskin.
No, but...
Hunchentoot.
Yes. Yeah, Hunchentoot. Mm. But the Larry Dwarf, and then there's... in Them or Us, when he interacts with Moon Unit, it's Frank Zappa, but he's not identified that in the script. But Frank Zappa is doing all the other stuff in the script. That's not him. That's Frank Zappa, the public image.
I remember with Them or Us, I had a really weird feeling when I looked down the list of people who are in a composition and Frank's not playing on the track. Did you experience that? There's one thing where it's composed and it's various people and he happens not to be playing. But that's so unusual.
Yeah.
You feel like something's sort of lost. It's like really strange. Like, where's he? I can't remember which track it is.
I can't think.
Yeah. He gave that up ages ago.
He thinks we're thinking. You think we're thinking. We're not thinking. We're just reading it off the clock here.
Just think.
Don't think, just think.
Drink.
Think,
don't,
drink,
don't think, just drink heavy in.
But see, you're talking you left. Your idea
else.
Of thinking is a verbal medium. I agree, an ancient medium. And we aren't thinking. We are. Is God ESP gamma? That's questions United. That's Zappa's question. Is God ESP?
See, thinking is.
I think we should have a break.
Imagining the object.
Gavin needs his drink.
Imagining.
Gavin needs a drink.
I can go out when I want
a
drink.
No, music is your drink.
I brought a little limited music with me.
I don't think logical
Random.
Positivism is thinking. I don't
I
think there's games with logic is thinking generating stuff out of that.
Mm.
But what's thinking is where you imagine
Religion
what you're trying
judge.
To understand again
right.
and use that to criticize all the concepts and terms that are in your brain.
Mm.
And therefore, you need a shared thing for us all to contemplate, which is why we can talk because we got Zappa, because we go back and think about that scene again, because we got it in our heads. We've got a common... something that isn't
a
set of words.
A mini Esperanto.
For us to face.
Are we?
Yeah.
We got the blues, man.
Yeah, we got the blues.
Perhaps there are people sitting around using Britney Spears for the same purpose.
Yes, exactly. Who knows?
Are we listening?